How well did you sleep last night? How much did you sleep last night? And how's your mental health? We're going to talk today about what researchers are learning about the connection between those questions, between mental health and sleep. And it comes down to this. If you have insomnia, you might want to talk to a mental health professional. And if you have anxiety or depression, you might want to get a sleep evaluation. Two guests to talk to me about it this hour are Dr. Michael Howell, who is the director of the Fairview Sleep Services in Edina. Good to see you again. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And Dr. Brent Nelson, co-director of the Center for Neurotherapeutics, which is through Prairie Care and is also in Edina. Brent, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
These two men often trade patients is one of the notes I got before this show. So we'll explain that in a moment. But I want to hear your questions about that. 1-800-242-2828. 651-227-6000. You can tweet me at WeberTom1. As you're listening, what do you want to know? I know we have a lot of interest whenever we talk about sleep and the science of sleep. So give us a call, but don't call or text if you're driving. So talk more about this, Michael. You trade patients. What do you mean by that? What are we talking about here?
Well, I mean, no one ever laid awake in a dark room and stared at the ceiling and thought about how great their life was. It's incredibly anxiety provoking. If you're not sleeping well, you're more likely to be depressed the next day. Mm-hmm. And conversely, if you have depression or anxiety, you're more likely to have trouble sleeping.
What begets what? Does the anxiety beget bad sleep, or does bad sleep beget anxiety?
It can start in either. It could start at either pole, really. You could be otherwise emotionally fine, and if you're just not sleeping well, you could easily develop an anxiety problem. Mm-hmm. And conversely, you could be sleeping well and have some depression issues and then start having middle-of-the-night insomnia or other sleepiness during the day.
What would you add, Brent?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you have one brain. And so with that, you're going to have a lot of complicated interplay between the different systems. And so folks who are very activated with worries are often going to lay awake at night and ruminate. Or they're going to try and figure out their problems, not necessarily at the most opportune time during the day. It's going to instead be at night.
But how do you know? I mean, there's a level at which you're speaking where I think everyone gets it, right? They think, well, that's a no-brainer, to use the phrase, pun intended, because, well, of course, if you're anxious, you're thinking about that thing due tomorrow at work or at school or something like that, you may lay awake. But there is also then this next step where clinical anxiety, clinical depression actually becomes a thing. How can you tell the difference between them?
Yeah, it's really difficult. I wish I could say we had a blood test or mm-hmm. a brain image that we could use in order to know exactly that this has become something worth treating. What I often do is really try and get a sense for how disruptive it is to someone's life. You know, normal anxiety, as I call it, is something that, like you said, we're all used to having. You have a big test the next day. Mm-hmm. You're going to feel apprehensive. You're probably going to sleep less that night. But when it really continues on day after day, it does start to wear you down. And that's where other things will come into the picture. You may get depression that starts to build. And that way, then you start losing interest in doing things. You're feeling more sad or unhappy than you would normally. And then you start to think, wow, this is a big problem. This is something we really need to look at treating.
One way to look at this is the difference between your brain making chemical connections versus permanent connections. And what I mean by that is when we are awake, our 100 billion brain cells are constantly talking to each other, and they work through chemical interaction. Mm-hmm. And the more you are working on a problem, say, mm-hmm. the more chemical interaction you have and the more likely you are to remember it after an hour or so. But more likely than not, you're going to forget that tomorrow or the next day unless you make a permanent connection between your brain cells. It is during sleep that this happens. So, and this can work in a positive way, whether or not you're trying to memorize a spelling list, mm-hmm. Whether or not you're trying to learn how to hit a golf ball or land a triple axel in figure skating. Or this could work against us in mental health problems, depression, anxiety. So we all have normal times when our mood is poor. We'll have times when we're anxious, mm-hmm. And that's okay. The problem is when it becomes a permanent change, and it is when we're sleeping that our brain will make these permanent connections And so if you have bad thoughts, anxious, maybe have post-traumatic stress disorder, chronic pain, it is when you are sleeping that you are making those maladaptive connections.
So what happens, just to explain that science a little further. So if the two cells are talking to each other when we're awake and alive, it almost sounds like it's a water gun fight where they're shooting chemicals at each other. And you're saying that during sleep at night, in order for that memory to stay, that water, and in this case, it's chemicals. Is it the chemicals themselves that are frozen, or does it something actually get built in the brain?
It's getting built. So your brain is 100 billion cells, but actually 100 trillion with a T connections. Mm-hmm. And it is all of those connections that make you you. Your memories, personality, professional skills, temperament. But there's a limit to how many more connections you can make. And during the day, as you're going about your daily life, listening to the radio, for example, mm-hmm. your brain is constantly changing. So your brain is going to be different an hour from now than it is right now. And when your brain cells talk to each other, they become stronger. So if one neuron is talking to a second one, the more they interact with each other, the stronger they become. Unfortunately, your brain is an enclosed space, so there's a limit to how many more connections you can make. And so it's at night that our brain trims all of these excessive synapses, all these connections down. And what we're left with then is during the day, we have 100 billion cells and 100 trillion little connections that are constantly kind of fighting over each other, over who's going to get more space. And then it's at night that it essentially prunes off that which is which is less important.
Right.
And so then the next day, you're ready to learn again. It's kind of like clearing off a blackboard so that you can learn again the next
morning.
But
keeping the part where the teacher wrote, don't erase this.
Exactly.
Right.
And we would hope that our connections that are really useful, that help us, have the right perspective on things are the ones that are connected the next day. But in the setting of mental illness, you can get caught into a trap where in all the wrong circuits and all the wrong anxieties are getting amplified so that when you experience something that may not appropriately deliver an anxious response is doing so the next day.
And I think there are more whiteboards in schools than blackboards, but I just wanted to be able to show your age there. But Brent, to that point, it's almost this spiral, because what I understand from what Michael said is that then at nighttime, instead of creating the connections to remember the thing for the test tomorrow, whatever history lesson you have to remember, your brain is actually working on making those connections permanent that are more related to having anxiety and depression. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah. And it's an additional challenge too, because what it is doing is it's sort of limiting your capacity for the future connections as well. We always talk about this thing called plasticity, mm-hmm. which is really brain flexibility. Just like Michael's saying, the ability to form these connections. And often, when we try and treat things like depression or anxiety, we can do it in a couple of ways. One is with medicines. People frequently use things like antidepressants or anti-anxiety medicines. But we'll also use things like therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, mm-hmm. supportive psychotherapy. And these are intended to help reset these connections in a way that allows you to reduce your symptoms and improve your resilience or your tolerance against a future episode of depression or anxiety. The challenge, though, is without the flexibility or the plasticity that you garner at night, it actually makes those medicines or the psychotherapies a lot harder to use, because your brain is more resistant to making that change, because it hasn't had the chance to really reset and regenerate the night before.
We're talking with Drs. Brent Nelson and Michael Howell about this connection between sleep and mental health. And again, on one level, I think it may seem to be an obvious connection, but I also am going to pursue this a little more with my guests about how obvious it really is in society and in our healthcare system, whether we're treating the right things. 1-800-242-2828. Would love to hear your questions for our guests here today as well. 651-227-6000. You can tweet me at WeberTom1. Let's take a call from Kara, who's in Hudson. Hi, Kara. What would you like to ask here today?
Hi. I'm actually kind of going to shift gears a little bit with you guys. I suffer from anxiety and depression, but I sleep fine at night, but I fall asleep like almost uncontrollably during the day as well.
Yeah. Well, Kara, I'm not actually sure that is too much of a deviation, Michael. I think that this actually does fit into what we were talking about. How?
Sure. So it's interesting. When people have mood problems, they often manifest itself in several different ways. And Brent can expand on this a little bit in a moment. One of which is many people will become quite somnolent. They'll become quite tired and sleepy. And being tired and sleepy is a miserable experience. It's also potentially dangerous, particularly when operating a motor vehicle.
Right.
And even if you're not falling asleep, sleepiness can interfere with our ability to function by just our ability to attend, to react appropriately, and to also have the right mental outlook when just looking at the world around us. Do we always focus on the negative as opposed to trying to appreciate positive aspects of our life?
So how well is this known, right? I mean, there's this level, Brent, where it seems obvious. You know, it's almost the two halves of my brain thinking, well, of course that's obvious that there would be this connection between mental health and sleep. But how obvious is that actually, A, in the healthcare system, and B, to the wider public? I think when we think about anxiety and depression and mental health, we think about talk therapy and what kind of medication you need. How often does the conversation focus on sleep?
You know, when people present with the concern about their sleep, it's obvious. And you start talking about it, you know. And we try and tease apart what's happening exactly. What's your sleep patterns? How do they fit in with your mood? Are the sleep problems there when your mood is fine? As the caller reported too, she said, you know, I feel like I'm sleeping okay, but I'm tired all the time and I have anxiety and depression. So I think the healthcare provider question is it's right there and it's present all the time. And that's why we're always looking for support from our sleep colleagues like Michael. I think in the broader population though, I think people often think about it sort of from a reductionist perspective, where they'll think, well, my sleep is something different than my mental health.
Right, exactly.
And I don't, you know, I think that's because we don't know exactly what causes depression. We don't know exactly what causes anxiety. You know, as Michael said, 100 billion neurons, 100 trillion connections. It's very complicated. And neuroscience is really doing some incredible things with neuroimaging, different ways to measure brain activity, trying to put together what does depression look like from a common pathway. Mm-hmm. The challenge is, though, with that complexity, we don't really have a good fingerprint yet. You know, there's been some really neat new literature showing that maybe there's some subtypes of depression based on what part of your brain seems to be working overtime or undertime with a particular set of symptoms.
Yeah.
But it's really just an approximation. It's just a glimpse into the actual underlying cause.
You know, but one thing I heard in your answer makes me think that it might, correct me if I'm wrong here, but it almost sounds like it's easier to draw the line between sleep and mental health if the thing you're going to the doctor for is the sleep first than the mental health first. That if you come in with a sleeping problem, you can draw the line quicker to anxiety or depression rather than vice versa. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Or you're grimacing, but you're nodding. I want to.
It's really tricky because the trouble is how we describe what's happening to someone. They're gonna come in and they're gonna say, "Gosh, you know, I'm not sleeping well. I'm feeling like my brain's kind of spinning during the night."
Mm-hmm.
And so what we're gonna do then is they're just gonna know what they feel. They're not gonna necessarily say, "Well, it's a sleep thing, so I should go to the sleep doctor," or it's a mm-hmm. psychiatry thing, so I should go to the psychiatrist. They're just gonna hopefully engage with whoever's sitting in front of them, often primary care,
right,
even. And so then the question is often like, well, what's next? What do we optimize first? And I think the way I think about it is we have to do both. And that's why I'll often say, well, let's get the sleep experts involved and let's see where the overlap is, kind of those old Venn diagrams where mm-hmm. you say, well, gosh, this is a complicated case and there's going to be an intersection between all these symptoms. And if one isn't better, then it's going to be hard to treat all of them.
One unifying aspect of this is our body's circadian rhythm. So our bodies have a 24-hour clock that controls everything about our lives. The most obvious manifestation is sleep wakefulness, but it's more than that. It's when we're alert. It's when our gut moves. It's when our different blood pressures, hormonal secretion, and sometimes that's the first place to start because it is the foundation for both our sleep mm-hmm. our wakefulness and our mental health. And for everyone listening, it's a reasonable exercise just to explore for a moment. If the whole world lets you, and you just listen to your body on when you would naturally get hungry, when you would naturally get sleepy, and when you would naturally wake up. And for some people that Brent and I see, it's almost impossible for them to understand this because they've been struggling for so long. They've been on numerous different medications to help them fall asleep, to help them wake up. Sometimes they're self-medicating. But even that is useful. Even that is just to recognize that I don't know where my body's 24-hour clock is, which another way to say it is I don't know where on the planet my pin would fall.
Yeah, you're not grounded.
You're not. And just to recognize, you know, we are on a planet that is spinning every 24 hours mm-hmm. and where your body naturally lands on it. And it's very easily to get lost because of all of the light exposure we have in the evening, as well as the lack of relative light exposure we have in the morning, particularly Minnesota wintertime.
Do we need to have another show about whether Minnesota should get rid of daylight saving time? I mean, do you sincerely have a view on that topic, and that should actually be a policy debate?
Well, I'm going to evade your question just a little bit, Tom, and say what I think if I could give one thing to everyone, particularly people who live in northern climes, if I give one thing to everyone, it would be a sunrise, and if you can't get the real sun, then bright light exposure, in particular a 10,000 lux light box, which just resets our body's 24-hour rhythm. Think about the way we evolved in East Africa with that big fusing ball of helium coming up over the sky every day. That resets all sorts of different physiological processes, including in mental health. And you'd be surprised at how much better your sleep gets over time with just getting a sunrise in the morning.
Do not mess with the circadian rhythm. That's the bumper sticker for today's show. Let's go to Carol in Fergus Falls, who has a question here about this. Hi, Carol. What would you like to know?
Hi. I would like to know, how is mental health like anxiety related to people with sleep apnea who don't get enough sleep from that problem?
Who wants to grab that,
sure,
Michael?
Sure. I'll take that. Thank you, Carol. So sleep apnea is the collapse of the upper airway during sleep. It's more common as we get older. It's more common if we've gained weight. It interferes with our brain's ability to get deep, restful, restorative sleep. And one aspect of not getting good sleep is, in addition to being sleepy the next day, you tend to focus on all of the wrong things. So an issue, whether or not you're driving or with a coworker or with a family, that might just completely roll off your back the next day. If you're not sleeping well, you tend to focus and perseverate on all the negative aspects of that. Brent?
Yeah, I totally agree. I think of anxiety in many cases as your threat detector. So that worry for protecting yourself, being able to engage the fight or flight. And when you haven't slept well at night, you're going to be hypervigilant because your body's going to know that something is up. It's going to say, gosh, I didn't sleep well. I don't exactly know why, but resources are short. I better be a little bit on edge. And so people will often know they'll snap a little bit more easily. Mm-hmm. They'll worry about things that, like Michael said, will just normally roll off your back. And they're going to have a harder time really focusing on the details of the day, like a test or a presentation at work. And because you're going to just feel spread a little bit thin.
We're talking with two doctors here, Brent Nelson from the Center for Neurotherapeutics and Michael Howell, who's the director of Fairview Sleep Services in Edina. And they work together as we're trying to bridge that connection and make that one of those trillion connections between those conversations we have about the science of sleep and the conversations we have on the science of understanding mental health. And we're taking your calls as well, 1-800-242-2828. Anne is in St. Paul. Hi, Anne. Welcome to NPR.
Thank you. I wanted to comment that I've always had very high energy levels, but erratic sleep patterns. And my energy would get so high that I could easily stay up all night at times and not feel a thing. And at other times, I'd feel like I got hit by a truck and I'd have to sleep for 3 days solid. I finally got diagnosed with bipolar disorder, which I discovered, at least for me, is more a disorder of energy levels than of mood. Mm-hmm. And that was a real revelation, and I'd just like to hear your comments.
Well, Anne, thanks so much. When you said the word bipolar, both guests here in the studio nodded. I mean, Brent, it almost sounded close to being textbook, but let's parse that out. Let's learn what we can learn from Anne's example. It started with this sleep issue where she was up one day, down the other, and then it became bipolar. I'm wondering if there's a way we can shorten that time between the sleep issues and the diagnosis.
Absolutely. She has such a wonderful description of bipolarity. You know, it's really so present in sleep. And it's really usually one of the main measures I use. You know, people will come in and will often have this question, am I bipolar? And the first thing I'll ask them is I'll say, tell me what your sleep is like.
Really? That is your first question?
Absolutely.
Really?
Yes, absolutely. Because, you know, the difficulty of the bipolar diagnosis is there was a lot of recognition of it in the 90s, where there was a lot of research and people were trying to diagnose it effectively, because the treatments for bipolarity are often a little bit different than just unipolar depression. And so there was this sensitivity to making the diagnosis. Well, really, it's kind of swayed back the other way, where people are saying, well, let's get back to the basics. And really, the basics of bipolarity is there has to be a mania. And what mania does is it makes your brain move very fast. And so generally the easiest way to tell that your brain is moving too fast is you don't require sleep. So people will say, gosh, I just had 2 days where I didn't sleep and I'm feeling great. I'm feeling actually top of the world, larger than life, ready to keep going. And people could go up to 3-4 days without sleep. The challenge, though, is sleep is non-negotiable. You have to pay it back. And so then there will be the crash, you know? And like she said, gosh, then I'm out for 3 days.
So what is the mania in that example? Is the mania related just simply to the ability to stay awake? Is that the mania?
Well, it's, I think, a little bit more complicated than that. The mania is the up of the bipolar. So you'll have mania contrasted with depression.
Mm-hmm.
And so the depression is usually low, vegetative, tired, sad, loss of interest, trouble with appetite, either eating too much, too little. But the mania is top of the world, feeling great, tons and tons of energy. And so it's a spectrum. It's not an all or nothing sort of thing.
Right.
You know, some people will be up for a day, some up for five.
Brent Nelson, Michael Howell with us. We're talking this hour about sleep and mental health. We're taking your calls as well. So let's go to Hallie in St. Paul. Hi, Hallie. What would you like to add here today?
Hi, I am a postpartum doula. And so I work with families as they are welcoming new babies. And I just think it's really interesting and important perspective to add that pretty much all the symptoms of perinatal mood disorders, such as anxiety and depression, are synonymous with lack of sleep. And
yeah,
of course, as we all know, newborns don't give us a whole lot of big stretches of sleep, particularly
really?
At night.
Really, Hallie? I was unaware of that. I had no idea.
And so that's when we see evidence of our clients starting to really suffer in their mental health and mood from life with a baby or multiple babies, then that's often the first recommendation their mental health professionals will give them, is you need to get at least 6 hours or more in one stretch at night. And that is challenging. And that's where a lot of times we come in to kind of try to help them facilitate that.
Wow. I really thank you so much for that call, Hallie, because I had a light bulb moment, Michael, as she was talking, because of course, in my mind, it is now so obvious that postpartum depression, which we hear so much about, mm-hmm. of course that has to be linked to sleep, right? And it is, right? I mean, can we confirm that really is a thing?
Absolutely. And Hallie, thank you as the father of twins. Thank you very much for mentioning multiples, because they bring their own challenges in terms of getting a good night's sleep.
But where do you start? Where do you, like, literally, where do you start on getting back that sleep?
So you start with the mom, and you start before any baby is born. Pregnancy has unique sleep challenges, particularly restlessness. So restlessness, sometimes thought of as restless leg syndrome, is the brain's inability to keep calm. So the brain is otherwise ready to fall asleep, but your body won't let you. This is caused by iron deficiency, which otherwise young, healthy women are relatively iron deficient in the first place. Then with pregnancy, with the massive mm-hmm. expansion of hemoglobin.
And the parasites sucking all of the stuff.
I didn't call it a parasite. But,
but yeah, I mean, that's what's happening.
It just absorbs all of the available iron. The brain is not able to create dopamine, which is particularly important in just keeping the body calm. So this can cause quite a bit of trouble sleeping for women when they are pregnant. And then once the baby is born, there's often they've started off with the last 9 months of not being able to sleep particularly well. Mm-hmm. All of the hormonal changes that happen with a newborn baby, and combined with a child who, when a baby's born, they don't know what planet they're on. Yeah. Is this a 12-hour planet? Is it a 36-hour planet? And to get back to our theme of what we're talking about, one simple intervention that all parents can do is, even though that child is going to be up and down throughout the course of the night, make sure you let them know when the sun comes up, with either the sun or, again, with a bright light box, just letting them know that this is the time of day when the sun normally comes up, and it'll start getting their circadian rhythm rolling.
So, Brent, when someone comes in and you're talking specifically about postpartum depression, and then you lead the conversation to sleep, and then their answer is, yeah, right, what else you got? What's your answer, right? Because you will get that initial response of, well, then you come raise my kids, that kind of a thing, right?
Yeah, it's really difficult. You know, I'm always trying to think about what sorts of support systems do they have? What are the realities of the constraints of their life? You know, do they have family in town that can help out? Do they have a partner? How are they going to make time for themselves? I mean, you have to do you have to really make or schedule time for the normal things, going to the bathroom, eating food, getting sleep. And you do need a break where you can just do something and have a little alone time. With that said, you know, there are the realities where someone has to care for the baby. So like Michael said, you know, really leaning on the things like phototherapy, the light boxes, mm-hmm. makes a huge difference.
In the kids' room too.
In the kids' room too.
Turn it on in the morning when the sun's coming up.
Or just open the drapes. You know, so often we're trying to shield this new child from everything. The sun is one thing we shouldn't necessarily shield them from.
You know, just this morning, Michael, we got an email from the Census Bureau. They sent out some new data, and it's so interesting that they sent it today, because it has to do with the number, because they do these studies, right? Census Bureau, children living with a parent who works non-standard hours, mm-hmm. which is basically you're not 9 to 5, it's nights and it's weekends. And I don't know the delineation between nights and weekends, but the night thing, percentage of children in this country living with a parent working a non-standard schedule, 18% of children have both parents with a non-standard schedule. And I think I'm saying that right as I read this graph. But so many children in this country are growing up where parents are working nights or weekends. Mm-hmm. Are they doomed? Like, are they going to grow up with this established wrong, and there's nothing we can do for them?
Oh, there's certain things we can do about it, but we must recognize that working overnight shifts has consequences to it.
For you and your kids.
Absolutely. 4 billion years of evolution have kind of determined that human beings would be, for the most part, asleep at night and awake during the day. But that's not for 20 million adult Americans who have to work overnight shift work.
We need the money.
That is, it particularly falls on in socioeconomic ways because it is the people who are most vulnerable who most need the money. And guess what? These shifts pay more. And so they often get caught into a trap. But what let's just talk about the consequences of overnight shift work. We know that overnight shift work leads to a variety of issues, including mental health concerns, anxiety, depression, substance abuse. But in addition to that, obesity, cardiovascular disease, malignancy. Now, that's all sounds very sobering, and I want to leave on a little bit of a good note here. A few things that you can do if support. Family and social support is so important because working overnight shift work is incredibly socially isolating. It is as if you are living in a parallel universe. Kids will wonder, why can't mom wake up and play with me? Mom absolutely needs her sleep. She's still going to be able to have that bonding time with you, but it's going to have to be a little bit later. If you're working overnights, bright light till about 2-3 o'clock in the morning. Sunglasses on the way home, avoid bright light in the morning, and then on your way home from work, and then a little bit of melatonin, just the over-the-counter vitamin supplement, right when you're going to bed at about 7-8 o'clock in the morning, whenever it would otherwise be. Blackout curtains. These are all interventions that have been studied and can help people adjust better to overnight shift work.
Let's go to Gene, who's in St. Paul. Hi, Gene. Your question here today.
Hey. Just a question about self-medicating. I've had problems sleeping for a couple of years, and then suddenly I discovered Advil PM. Now, unfortunately, I've gotten to the point where it seems like if I feel like I don't take it, I'm not going to sleep well, which seems to be the case. My brain will be going 1,000 miles an hour. I'll wake up 10 times. Am I doing something stupid to myself by taking this regularly?
Brent?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, there's always two parts to it, I think. One is the part where what's your body used to and what's the environment that your body's sleeping in. The other part, though, is what's your brain gotten used to? You know, it's tricky with some of these PM products. The first thing you want to be careful about is what else is in the PM product. Because sometimes it can be Tylenol and sometimes it can be ibuprofen, and they all have impacts. So you want to talk to your primary care doctor about, you know, could that be affecting your liver or your kidneys? The bigger question, though, is kind of like, what sort of routine have you gotten into? What's sort of the habit that's formed for your body and your brain, where your brain kind of forgets how to initiate sleep because it's used to something else helping out? So often what we'll do is work with folks either via just standard supportive therapy, where we can talk about what, you know, how can we reset sort of your routine in the evening when you're getting ready for bed to let your body more naturally kind of fall in back into that rhythm.
One of those is the screen time thing that we hear about, Michael. Get rid of the iPad and the iPhone right before bed.
Do the best you can with that.
Yeah.
for those who absolutely have to be on a screen, at least try to give yourself 30 to 60 minutes without it right before bedtime. And also, tablet computers and iPhones have they're called a night shift. Android has the same thing, where it blocks blue wavelengths. And you can set it, if you just go to your settings, block the blue wavelength. And it'll take all of 5 seconds for your eyes to adjust. The screen looks a little bit more orange. Then you can go back to watching Stranger Things or Game of Thrones, and you won't notice any difference.
What is a normal night sleep?
That's a good question.
What do we think it is, and what is it?
And let me just change your definition a little bit from normal to healthy.
Got it.
Okay. So as the evening progresses, you should start to get sleepy. You should not have to tell yourself, gee whiz, you know, I got to get up early tomorrow morning, so I better go to bed, even though I don't feel like it, nor do I want to. You should naturally start getting sleepy. You should actually start kind of dozing off. That is your brain telling you it is time to fall asleep.
As it gets dark, or as it gets a certain time?
After it's been dark for several hours and as you are approaching bedtime. And let's just, for the sake of convention, say it's 11 o'clock, an 11 o'clock bedtime. You go to bed. You fall asleep within 10 to 15 minutes. You should not have to force it. You should have, flipping this around a little bit, you should have to force your brain's ability to fall asleep and feel sleepy about as much as you force yourself to feel hungry. You don't. It should just feel naturally and start coming over you like a wave. You fall asleep, and then it's perfectly normal to wake up occasionally throughout the course of the night. Sleep is not one prolonged homogeneous state of unconsciousness. We normally should wake up about every hour and a half, couple hours. That's perfectly fine. Get a drink of water, go to the bathroom. But then, again, be able to fall asleep within about 5-10 minutes. You should wake up, so in this case, in this example, say about 7 o'clock in the morning, and you shouldn't be able to sleep in any later. If I come in, and this is, we work with some, one of the things that we've talked about before, Tom, is athlete sleep, trying to help improve the performance of athletes by sleeping as well as possible. The goal is that you wake up in the morning, 7 o'clock, whatever time it is, and you couldn't sleep any longer, even if I came in with $1,000 for you to sleep 10 more minutes. Now, that's a hard goal to reach. But for those who are trying to optimize their performance to the very top, it's the goal to reach for.
What about naps?
Oh, napping is normal. So that sleepiness, many of us feel 1-2 in the afternoon when we haven't had caffeine and we're sitting down, that is part of your body's natural sleepiness. And you can become a good napper by practice. Many people are thinking to themselves about the times that they nap and they wake up and they feel worse than when they started. Well, that's because they're not a very good napper.
Yeah.
And it takes practice. Just like exercise takes practice, just like getting into a good diet takes routine. Recognizing that your body has a natural nap time, getting into a routine of and the environment, hopefully, where you can do it, which, let's face it, many of us can't, including myself, with a clinic in the afternoon and everything else. But then just getting used to practicing. And first times you try it, you may not feel like you fell asleep. If you ever wake up and you're a little chilled, if you ever open your eyes and you felt a little chilly, you actually fell asleep. One of the first things that your body does is it resets itself about a half of a degree Celsius, which is one of the reasons why we sleep under blankets.
And sleep debt, the idea that we'll make it up on the weekend, is that I've heard that that's just bunk and in this world.
Well,
we can't expect to make it up.
Short-term sleep deprivation can be made up. Chronic sleep deprivation has the consequences that we talked about before. Short-term sleep deprivation is okay as long as it's in moderation. And the general rule of thumb I say is that if you should be able to catch up on all of your sleep with as much as or less than 2 hours of extra sleep on the weekends.
Got it. So if you have to sleep 3 extra hours on the weekend,
you're moving in the wrong direction.
Let's go back to the phones here. Anne in Minneapolis, your question here today.
Hi there. Thanks. This is perfect time for you to take my call. So I related very much to the postpartum doula's comments. I have a 20-month-old. The sleep deprivation just about sunk me after a lifetime of being a very buoyant person. I did end up taking some medication because I just couldn't get enough sleep. Now I'm still on the medication. I'm doing really well. I get more sleep, but still not enough. But my big question is about napping, because every day I have to choose usually between napping and exercising. And they both are so helpful for mental health. And so I'm just wondering if one did have to choose, is it more important to get that nap, which always makes me feel so much better?
Yeah.
I'd love to hear the comments about that.
Well, it's thank you, Anne, and we're sorry that you're going through all of that. You're talking to a biased individual. I mean, I'm a sleep doctor who greatly values it, exercise.
Yeah.
But what I let me put it this way: when medical students come and I give talks, I will encourage them, if they start to get drowsy, to just go ahead and fall asleep and take a nap, because I'd much rather have you asleep for 10 or 15 minutes and then awake and alert and.
What, you mean in class?
In class.
You're okay with people falling asleep in class?
It is encouraged.
Sign me up.
And the reason why that is because after that 15 minutes, you're so much sharper, you're so much better ready to go.
Yeah.
And I would argue that, you know, there's measurements of physical activity, even though you might not be going out and, you know, jogging a 5K. The term is non-exercise activity thermogenesis, which is a long phrase to explain the calories we burn just when we are awake and moving around normally. And if you get a good nap, you're going to be probably burning off more calories in a healthy manner. So, yeah. Brent,
sleep,
any comment?
Sleep or exercise, Brent?
I totally agree. I think sleep is certainly the thing to do first. You know, exercise is extremely important, but you're at a unique time in your life, and you're at a unique time with your baby as well. And so I think, making some adjustments and saying, well, I'm going to focus on my sleep. I'll get back into a normal exercise routine once things sort of stabilize.
Never argue with a body. It's a fight you can't win.
Listen to your body. What about, as we come to the end of our discussion here, the idea, especially, you know, a couple people on Twitter saying, hey, I'm a night owl, or I've worked myself into this scenario. Maybe now I got a new job where I have to get up early, or whatever. I just want to think about changing my routine so it's a little healthier, or in line, I guess I should say, with the circadian rhythm. What do you tell people? How do you even start if you've gone down this spiral?
Focus on the morning. When you're a night owl and you're trying to shift out of that, the common mistake people make is they try to think themselves or trick themselves into falling asleep earlier. That doesn't work. You need to move your body's 24-hour rhythm, and that is done with bright light in the morning. So if it's midnight, 1, 2 o'clock in the morning, you're not falling asleep yet, get out of bed, stop trying. Be mindful when you do get sleepy and go back to bed when you get sleepy, but then focus like a laser beam on waking up at the same time, get help from family and friends if you need to, and get that bright light exposure. You are inducing jet lag as if you are traveling to Europe. But if you do that for a good week or so, your body will reset and the sleepiness will naturally fall into place later.
So you will have a rough week.
No question. No question. But it's to some degree, you're paying it forward. So you're tired, you're sleepy, and as long as you're careful driving, that sleepiness is being paid forward so that even though you're getting a bad night of sleep tonight, you'll be better able to sleep the next night or the night after that.
I think it also is important to consider what your goals are. You know, just because we're everyone feels like they're supposed to sleep from 10 p.m. to 6 a.m., if you the constraints of your life are such that you can be a night owl and enjoy it and be okay with it and have it be consistent with your work-life balance, that sort of thing, that's okay. You know, and so if you're really setting a goal where you're like, well, because of work or whatever that is, I do have to be up, well, then you can sort of logically make those decisions and not be, you know, too hard on yourself.
So, but you agree, focus on the morning. So absolutely. Turn that light on at mm-hmm. the same time every morning, mm-hmm. especially now in our Minnesota winter. Mm-hmm. So you have one at home. You turn it on.
Oh, I do. Yeah, I turn it on for my three daughters who are not really thrilled, but it does. They're great sleepers.
Right. And that means we didn't even get into the high school start time debate, which is a big debate. But I feel like I know where you guys stand on that. The idea that you move the start times around to where kids are sleeping.
A little, you just move it a little bit in the right direction. Adolescents normally are naturally night owls. It's not just parental avoidance. You let them sleep in a little bit longer. They do better academically, less interactions with law enforcement, substance abuse.
Thank you both for being here. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Dr. Michael Howell from Fairview Sleep Services, Brent Nelson, co-director of the Center for Neurotherapeutics.